Fan Morning Show, Sports 759 of the Fan. We made it. It's Friday. We stayed up late. We watched the Toronto Raptors pick at number 33. What a night. I love the NBA draft. It's always like, hey, this is going to be a billion trades. You're not going to believe the things you're going to see tonight. And it's just like the only traditions remain constant. One, the betting line is always right, not the insider. Two, the Toronto Raptors love a guy whose qualities are improved over seasons at college. Three, the Sacramento Kings will screw something up and, and absolutely unequivocally not take the best player that is in front of them. And four, there will be far, 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 far less trades for actual NBA players than actually get reported throughout the week and get theorized throughout the week. Good morning, Ailish Forfar. How are we doing today? You're back in the studio, which means you still don't have air conditioning. So
hey, today's supposed to be the day, everybody. I got a message from the property manager. Today should be the day, but I've also had that same email for about 4 weeks in a row. So
you've also been getting text messages from me about my air conditioning.
And yeah, this is so rude. Like, listeners need to hear this. JD sends me a voice note last night. And the thing about a voice note is you never know what's going to happen, right? You just press it. He goes,
okay, you didn't say that smart.
Do I sound stuffed up? Because it's just so cold in my apartment that I think I have a cold.
Yeah.
And then the other day, he texts me, hey, do you have any extra blankets? It's really freezing in my apartment. And I said, karma's coming, JD. I'm going to remember all these things, all the ways that you have tormented me in my 32-degree apartment, and something will happen to you, and you will remember that this is why.
Shout out to me. Those are even funnier jokes when I hear them back, you know? shout out to me and my comedic stylings. Those are hilarious jokes. Okay, so yeah, the Raptors. We got to start with that. I'll say this. This kid is out of my depth a little bit when it comes to the research that I did. I tried to look around and see who was going to be in the Raptors range, and so I do know about him. And yeah, I actually do like Pac-12 basketball. That's my preferred conference. But this year was not exactly the watching Pac-12 that I'm accustomed to, considering we shifted to a show that starts at 6 o'clock in the morning. So I have not seen this kid, Christian Coloco, the way that I normally would have seen a kid who plays at Arizona, which happens to be like a school my uncle went to and one that I tracked fairly closely. But anyways, I have seen him play. I will say that my impressions of him when he did play were pretty damn near close to a lot of what you will hear from people that watched him a lot, which is he is an imposing figure when he is at the rim. But he's not exactly the strongest dude for his size. Guys will out-leverage him to a certain degree. And he definitely, like, is not – you're not putting him in the corner to knock down any threes. And I don't think you're going to be doing that anytime soon. Though that did remind me of something Blake Murphy said to us yesterday, which is like, hey, the Raptors don't care about shooting. They feel like they can improve that. They feel like they can break that down. They can add that to somebody's package. And this kid, by all accounts, is extremely hungry. And he's from the same hometown as Pascal Siakam, which is going to be the like number one social media thing that you hear about this kid. And I'm sure Pascal has done something. Like, again, I went to bed and I haven't seen anything from like the Raptors standpoint. But I actually think that there's a fair comparison here in that Siakam got better at like was a late bloomer, got better and better as things progressed through college. Was someone who had a lot of defensive upside and people did not view as like an offensive guy. He had way more playmaking skills than Coloco. Like, Coloco is someone where they don't really trust him even in dribble handoff situations. Like, he is a pure rim finisher. Like, you lob the ball up, he's going to catch that sucker and throw it down. But there's not a lot of offensive versatility to his game right now. But the reason why I bring this up is because if you remember Pascal Siakam's early career, it was, hey man, these are the things that you can do. Run down the floor as fast as you can, catch an outlet pass, finish at the rim. Or number two, be in the dunker spot, catch the ball, shoot a short little jumper, but we don't even really want you doing that. So if there's one thing I trust with the Toronto Raptors, it's that they can improve this area of someone's game. I will always believe that you cannot teach measurables and you cannot teach having that dog in you, which is by all accounts what this kid has. He's got incredible wingspan. He's going to fill immediately a need for the Raptors.
Like, he's 7'1".
Yeah. And he's not a baby. He's not 19 years old.
That was actually one of the things, the only things. I mean,
I don't mean baby in terms of crybaby. Yes. I mean baby as in, like, he's 22.
Everybody loves to say, oh, I had this guy on my radar, and I really hope that people did. That's great.
Of course they did. He was one of the depth centers in the NBA draft, and the Raptors need a center. That really doesn't make you that big.
But one of the only things that I saw in terms of a potential negative, other than him needing to get tougher and maybe not having the best shot selection, is that he's 22 years old. And you could spin that as experience, as, he's played enough. He started his career really late. He played soccer until he was, I don't know, what age all of a sudden he started to play basketball and he was in his teens. So he's new to the game of basketball. He's 22 years old. That was the only thing that I saw reading reports about him, scouting reports, Raptors writers, is that could be a potential. Well, he's already 22. What does that mean? But if anyone can develop, it's the Raptors. And so if he gets some G League time and he's up and down, I still think that there's a lot of potential there. But just something to chew on is the age a little bit older than most of the people in the draft.
So he turned 22, I think, this week. So he's not like 22 turning 23. He just turned 22. I'm sure he will get some G League seasoning. Like, the Raptors are pretty smart with that. But by all accounts, I think this is someone who's already, like, one of their backup centers, and that they're going to let him work at the NBA level. Like, that's my kind of interpretation as to why they made some of this pick, is that he has a skill set that they currently do not have on the roster. And, like, I'll get into some of the more of the Raptors philosophical stuff here in a second in terms of, like, the direction of the franchise. But, yeah, 22 is 22 is an old player for the draft. But I do think that the Raptors were in a bit of a unique situation where this wasn't a draft that was full of crazy upside guys at these picks. And that's usually what you do in the second round, is you take kind of lottery tickets and flyers. But this is a guy who can kind of project out with both things, which is he can show a lot of improvement, and he might be able to do it over sometimes. And this is a little bit of the thing with Norm Powell. Sometimes the kids that are 22 and have already gone through the, like, year and year over of improvement and are a little bit age ready, closer, they have an advantage of over their peers of a little bit more urgency. Sometimes you draft a kid when they're 19, they're 20 years old. They might have all the potential in the world. They don't actually realize the urgency in which they need to try and improve, because they're not exactly sure, they're a little bit more confident that they have more time. For this kid here, what is going to be fascinating is he is a, yes, late bloomer prospect who has shown tons of improvement year over year at college, but there's probably a lot more desire for him to try and capitalize on improvements right now, because the NBA path is right there in front of him. He's not like, even with Malachi Flynn, it was, hey man, you're starting your career behind Kyle Lowry and Fred VanVleet. Like, good luck trying to get on the floor, right? This guy's not buried. I'm guessing Chris Boucher will get a contract offer from somebody and be out of town. And that's going to clear up a spot immediately, which leaves you with Kem Birch and Precious Achiuwa. Kem Birch might have knees that are degenerative and not even capable of having him play a certain amount of time this season. Like, I don't think he's ever playing 82 games, okay? Let's put it that way. The Raptors will probably have some smaller, funky lineups, but we're talking about a position right now for that team where you have Precious Achiuwa and then question mark Kem Birch games, then small ball lineups. He'll have a chance to play for this team this year. He's 22. Again, the wingspan is huge. The shot blocking instincts are very real. He obviously is going to have to get stronger. Here's what I like about him. Again, can't teach the measurables, can't teach the heart. But you absolutely can teach how to rebound better, strength and conditioning with an NBA-level program, NBA-level diets, and shooting And simple things like pick and rolls, dribble handoffs. I don't think that this dude is going to be able to become an NBA All-Star someday. But at 33, in a deep draft, if you can get a shot-blocking rim protector who can play and drop coverage, you've done a good job. So I like the pick. I think that it's a smart pick. It's kind of hard to hate on it. I don't really think that they could have done anything at 33 where I would have had a strong opinion in terms of them making a mistake. Mm-hmm. But in terms of things I wanted the Raptors to address, which was to get a little bit deeper and was to get somebody like this, they did a good job. If you recall, the guys that I was high on, if they would have traded up in the draft, would have been Mark Williams out of Duke and Jalen Duren. And so this guy is, I think, by most accounts, the fifth, maybe fourth rated center who can play and drop coverage in this, like pure drop coverage center. So yeah, I think that the Raptors acquitted themselves well.
Okay, so they moved back to 33. They would have selected at 20.
Yeah.
Malachi Branham was selected there for the Spurs. Does that make you look any different at the Thad Young trade after the draft has settled and seeing what the Raptors did receive?
Branham didn't, but so two things. In the moment, I was actually pretty frustrated that the Raptors had traded down, because some guys who were projected lottery picks who I really liked started to fall into the mid-teens. And once we got out of the lottery and AJ Griffin was there, I thought, what would it have cost the Raptors to trade up? And that's what I think will be the real point of curiosity for me in terms of alternate timelines, is how much did the Raps covet any of the kids that fell? Again, Duren fell. Pistons went and scooped him. Griffin fell. Williams fell. There were multiple players that I really liked as fits for the Raptors who I thought could contribute right away and also fit perfectly or seamlessly into their player development system. Younger players as well than Koloko. Bobby Webster, I saw a little tiny snippet of his media conference from last night. I was watching it when I woke up this morning. He says that their phone was quiet for the first hour of the draft. But would your phone have been quiet if you had pick number 20 instead of pick number 33? I'm not sure. The only thing is, my guess, and again, this is just a guess, well, we have Bobby Marks on later in the show today, is that it actually, they may have made a smart gambit in the sense of maybe there wasn't that much difference. Because once we did get into the 20s, it was sort of lottery ticket time in this draft, and there was a lot of fluidity in terms of guys that I had seen all over the map in terms of mock drafts of where they were going and how much higher they went or how much lower they went. So I do think that there was a lot of there wasn't a lot of consensus on picks 20 to 33. I think that the Raptors read that correctly, but I wonder if they read correctly some of the guys that fell into the late lottery, the early non-lottery, and whether or not having 20 would have changed something for them. And so like that's kind of it for me, is would you have been able to add a little bit closer to a, I don't want to say blue chip talent, because I don't think that that's what a lot of those guys are, but closer to that, like guys who played at major programs, guys who were viewed as higher star recruits to college. That will sit with me for a while. I think the bigger thing is they don't make the trade for OG Anunoby, or they don't trade away OG Anunoby. They don't make the trade for number 7. I'm okay with that, especially given that Shaedon Sharpe was the pick, and I just think that that's like such a high-risk swing play that if you're trading OG Anunoby and you end up with Shaedon Sharpe and Josh Hart, I don't know. When thinking about that and seeing it on paper, I'm really not sure, and I really don't know if the value of 7 was going to be that great, considering there were some guys that, again, I liked in that spot that fell well beyond 7. So had the Raptors taken somebody there, it might have been an overdraft. That said, Michael Grange yesterday, when he reported that the Raptors would not be trading OG Anunoby, or it looked as though they weren't going to be trading OG Anunoby. I want to pull the actual tweet up. There's a lot in Grange's feed, obviously. But it was along the lines of, they're going to continue with the patient approach, right?
Mm-hmm.
That this was going to be the way that they did this. And so, yeah, all indications are, this is the quote from Grange, quote, "All indications are Raptors will not be making moves to get into the draft lottery, i.e. moving OG Anunoby. No surprise there. Most of the energy has been coming from Portland, working to add veterans around Lillard. Toronto is still in be patient and grow mode," end quote. Be patient and grow mode is a smart strategy a lot of the time. And it's a decent strategy for the Toronto Raptors. But they do not have the runway that I think some people think they do. And this is my only thing with not making a decision about OG right now. It's about not making a decision on Fred right now. It's about having Gary Trent Jr. You look at the Raptors' most important pieces. Pascal Siakam is going to be getting a raise. They're a team that's capped out right now. Like, you do not have a bunch of salary cap wiggle room. Do they have Scottie Barnes as their most important franchise piece? Absolutely young kid who just won Rookie of the Year. Absolutely. But if you look at the Toronto Raptors' contracts, they have decisions to make because they've given a lot of guys player options. And this is something that might end up coming back to bite them in the ass a little bit. Fred VanVleet has 1 year really left on his deal because he has a player option in 23-24. And here's my guess about Fred VanVleet. Here's my guess about player options in general. If players opt into one-year deals as player options, it means that something bad has happened to them and that you as a team are not going to view that as very friendly. OG Anunoby has 2 years left on his contract. So Fred, 1 year. OG, 2 years. Gary Trent, 1 year. Like, Siakam, 2 years left on his contract after this one. There's just, the Raptors do not have a crazy long runway here. So going into this offseason, had they been able to kind of find a direction that either was, hey, we're going to consolidate one of these guys into some depth, or we're going to use one of these guys in a trade package for something different. You lose some flexibility. You lose some flexibility going into the season and going through the wait and see thing. I don't think that OG's trade value is going to materially change, but he is somebody who's been through injuries before. Like, this is the major criticism of him. Yes, he's only 24 years old, but if he goes into another season, he gets another injury. I do wonder how that would affect his trade value if they do decide to do that. Pascal Siakam, when he turns 29 years old and you're getting closer, then all of a sudden you're only 1 year removed from having to sign a contract extension with him and Fred VanVleet, who will both be, 29. How will that look? Will the Raptors be looking to sign up for through ages 30 to 35? Probably. I'm probably guessing that. But will they be willing to do that with all four of those guys? I don't know. It's just there are going to be some major decisions that come here quickly. That's all I'm saying. Is that by not acting yesterday or not acting this offseason, and there's plenty of offseason to still go, the wait and develop thing, I'm just saying, it's not like they're the Detroit Pistons right now, where wait and develop means you have 4 years with young guys. The Raptors, essentially, are on a one-year runway with two of their contracts and four of their decisions, in my opinion. Anyway, so the Thad Young thing, I think that it's the only way that you can really play it out is through a trade-up hypothetical, and if you're not looking at it through that lens, then it's a totally fine move. They added a veteran. He did help them. He gave them some depth. He keyed to the Raptors that they were going to be pushing for the postseason, that they cared about winning, and he's someone who I think, as long as they don't overpay him, should absolutely be re-signed.
Okay, before we move on to NHL, you mentioned the Pistons. I assume that they're in your winners column. I want to get a winner and a loser from you last night from the NBA draft. Mine, Pistons, is one of my winners, but what do you have?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm on the Pistons as well. A lot of people are going to pick the Pistons as winners. I'll say this, though. I actually will give the Knicks a nod as a winner. They didn't add anything. But they made a ton of moves that were super confusing throughout the night. And you went, well, what exactly is this? They traded, ultimately, I think 4 second-round picks and their pick in this year's draft and got out of the Kemba Walker contract, which was...
making a lot of room for something.
Well, I don't know. But here's the thing about the Kemba thing is that they did it to themselves. It's like it's the same thing as like the Nick Ritchie. You trade off a Nick Ritchie. I'm like, well, you. No one told you you had to go and get Kemba. You know, Kemba wasn't some unfortunate situation that fell into your lap. You guys went out and acquired him in an attempt to like rehabilitate him, and people were celebrating the return of a New York guy. And now a year later, he's like costing you a significant asset to get off of it. So I temper my praise here. All I'm going to say is that the Knicks essentially traded the 11th pick, which I liked some of those players. Again, they got Jalen Duren in that spot, and I would have loved Duren on the Knicks. They already have Mitch Robinson, so you could argue the fit there, but there was some real value at that 11 spot, I thought, anyways. But it wasn't like astronomical, knock you down, you have to have it value. They move off the Kemba Walker contract, and they traded 4 second-round picks, but they got 3 future first-round picks. So we'll see what those values of those 3 firsts are. But I do think that gives you a lot of flexibility if you're New York moving forward. I think that gives you more flexibility in the we could trade for a star if you have 3 first-round picks than if you have one of these guys from this year's draft who enters a Knicks situation that isn't overly healthy right now, where there isn't a ton of room for growth, development, and there isn't, frankly, a long track record of success when it comes to Knicks and development. So, yeah, I kind of liked what the Knicks did. I just think that them adding flexibility, getting off of the Kemba Walker contract, and ultimately only sacrificing 11 a pick that maybe they didn't love as an organization, I just don't think it's bad. So I thought that one was a little, like, more controversial, but I personally liked it. My loser is just the Sacramento Kings.
I knew that was coming.
Well, again, it's easy to pick on these guys, but it's like, this is one of those things where I hate saying it like this because I do not encourage bullying. All right. This is a very anti-bullying show, but it does remind me of the kid. It is. I like teasing. I don't like bullying.
There's
but
a fine line. You're right.
But the Kings are, they do remind me of the kid who is like the super dork that advertises it, you know, like that tries to like makes it even harder on themselves. You go, just try a little bit to not make it so hard. And the Kings just are that year over year. It would be one thing if they were the Raptors, right? Like the Raptors make the Scottie Barnes pick last year, and a lot of people criticized them, including me, about passing on Jalen Suggs. Because you go, why not take the best player available, the consensus top player, blah, 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 blah. Go on down the line. But the Raptors at least, and guess what it was always couched with by myself and by every other person that criticized the picks or preferred Jalen Suggs or wanted Jalen Suggs was... yeah, but, I mean, Cy Ujiri has a pretty damn good track record here, so he's probably right. Guess what? He was. Sacramento Kings, they do not get said luxury. they do not. You do not get the benefit of the doubt of, well, these guys have drafted well in the past. This is the organization that has an owner that was most famous for sitting around a room and going, Stauskas? Stauskas? And having a bunch of yes men look at him and go, yeah, sure, Nick Stauskas. and listen, no shade at Nick Stauskas. Proud the Canadian getting picked in the lottery, but was not a good pick. He's not an NBA player. And they took him, I think, number 6. This is an organization that passed on Luka Doncic to take Marvin Bagley Jr. and then didn't even play Marvin Bagley Jr. and essentially had him force his way out of town. This is a team that passed on Damian Lillard, who is the apple of everybody's eye at the NBA draft, who had more hype and more run-up to the draft than few players that I've ever seen, because nobody was watching Weber State games, but Damian Lillard was the, oh my God, you should see this guy at workouts. He's, like, impressing everyone.
And then Klay Thompson as well.
And also Klay Thompson. They've made an immense amount of draft gaffes, but these are all ones that you just mentioned. It's not like they made a gaffe of they passed on Klay Thompson. Lots of teams did. Mm-hmm. It's that they passed
they
on him
picked
to take
right
another.
Before him.
But not even just that. They traded up. They traded up that year to get number 10, and they picked a shooter, and they picked Jimmer freaking Fredette, who a lot of people liked. And Jimmer, it looks funnier in hindsight, but Jimmer was not mocked to go that high. Nobody really thought. A lot of people had question marks about Jimmer and his translation to the NBA level. And if you were going to go with a shooter, yeah, he was transformational in that regard, but Klay Thompson was also a bucket getter in college at Washington State. So it was not a it was a controversial pick at the time as well. So yes, it's the one picks away thing for the Kings. It's the fact that they have an organization that passed on Luka Doncic because of potential rivalries between a GM and a father. Like, they're just a poorly, they're run piss poor. Like, they are a piss poor run organization. And for them to pass on Jaden Ivey at four, it might work out well for them. It's the NBA draft. Usually, and this is much like the NFL draft or anything, whenever there's a consensus, you should usually be a little afraid. But what's not to love about Jaden Ivey? His path to being a successful star in this league could not be more clear. You watch the highlights of this kid. He looks like an absolute
His
monster.
Interviews last night were my favorite part of getting to know players. Him
well,
and his mom.
Who doesn't love a mama's boy?
Oh, like, it was beautiful. And he was, you know, openly quite emotional, which, you know, that pulls on
love,
the, pulls on the heart strings, you know?
you got to love him using, like, guy 101 to win the affections of a woman, which are, I love my mother. And every woman's like, oh. Openly being emotional, loving your mom. Like, boom. Way to go, Jaden Ivey.
Fan
you have
favorite.
Every female watcher of the draft in your corner, buddy. Like, congrats. You got off to an awesome start. So, yeah, I just think the Kings constantly overthink it. And I think that the NBA draft is a spot where if you're drafting for fit or you feel like you can't take a guy because he doesn't fit from a positional standpoint that high in the draft, you are doing something that's brutal. Again, look at the Raptors' pick of Scottie Barnes. People went, they already have OG and they already have Pascal. Why are you adding this guy? Boom, rookie of the year. That's how you do it. You don't draft for positional fit in the top of the lottery, for God's sakes. How many times do you have to do it, Sacramento? And the worst part is, like, I like Sacramento. I grew up with the Chris Webber white chocolate teams, Peja Stojakovic, Vlade Divac. I rooted for them. Arco, like, the crappy arena, the loud, crappy arena. I wanted them to win. I thought they got robbed by the Lakers. I was all in on them. I have a Sacramento Kings jersey, for God's sakes. I've been to that stadium. I've seen multiple games of the Sacramento Kings live. I root for that organization. I was glad that they didn't move to Seattle as a Seattle Supersonics fan, because I said that city does not deserve losing their fan base just because they will not fork over billions of taxpayer dollars in order to succumb to it. And although they ended up getting a mayor who was a former NBA player, they ended up doing that anyways. But I root for Sacramento, and I just hate watching them shoot themselves in the foot over and over and over again. And I think it's pretty bad when the Knicks have a night where I go, they're a winner, and I look at the Sacramento Kings and I say, you're still a loser. So those are my top winners and losers from the draft.
All right. NBA done. Good wrap up. We got Bobby Marks.
I have one other thing I want to quickly talk about.
Canadian?
Well, I want to talk about the Kyrie Kevin Durant.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We got to fit that in.
Okay, so right before the draft, Kyrie, classic attention-seeking Kyrie, leaks through Adrian Wojnarowski that he's not happy about he's not happy about where he's at with the Nets, which is insane because, again, the Nets are offering a bunch of money. They just don't want to give him a long-term contract because he's Kyrie. And he's played fewer games with the Nets than he's played. He has proven himself that it's beyond the vaccine mandate stuff. It's that he is a mercurial guy who might not show up. James Harden left town because of him. And in doing this, his search for leverage has been, this is Kyrie's leverage. I'm just crazy enough to leave my player option on the table and take $30 million less to go sign a mid-level exception with the Lakers. People think that, yeah, if there's anybody that'll do it, it'll be the guy that I think left about $18 million on the table last year and is already a very, very wealthy man, someone who's actually charitable, but I don't think is someone who is overly concerned about money, but could end up leaving it to go play for the Lakers. And number two is that Kevin Durant is pissed. And that, oh boy, well, if Kevin Durant is pissed, then maybe the Nets have to do something extra to make sure Kyrie Irving stays with Brooklyn. Two things. One is, I just think that this is why you can't reason with Kyrie, and this is why I think that the star model has to change a little bit in terms of leverage by teams. Teams for so long, and they will continue to do this with the ultimate superstar players, they've done this like, don't worry, you can have our franchise. Whatever you want, you're running it. And this was like kind of the LeBron model. And the LeBron model works for LeBron in his prime. It doesn't necessarily work for anybody else. And even Kevin Durant, which again, you would do 10 times out of 10 if you said, hey, you're going to sign Kyrie and you're going to do this and blah, blah, blah. I think teams have to be a little bit more cautious in terms of what they do moving forward and how much they give to star players and how much they just seed themselves. But the whole KD could end up leaving thing or asking for a trade. I have two fake trades that I made last night in the trade machine. So number one, and I sent these to Blake Murphy. So I'm going back to our text message to be like, what do you think about these things? I think it would be very, very fun. Number one, I've proposed that the Miami Heat trade Kyle Lowry, Duncan Robinson, Tyler Hero,
wow,
and three first-round picks, unprotected, in 2023, 2025, and 2027 for Kevin Durant, Patty Mills, and Nick Claxton. Trade number two, the Memphis Grizzlies trade Steven Adams, Dylan Brooks, Zaire Williams, Desmond Bane, and two future unprotected first-round picks for Kevin Durant and Patty Mills. Memphis would be the most fun for me because of all the trash talk that's gone on between the Grizzlies and the Warriors.
What did Blake think of that?
He like, I won't speak for him, but...
He didn't respond, eh? No likes like me. Thumbs up?
No, we had conversations about both. And we both liked the Memphis one the most. He would be terrified of the Miami one. Was I think the way that he put it, where he was like, I wouldn't want to see that because they would... No. That's not why.
That's
he thinks that it would work out well for them and that they would end up winning the East. But I like the Memphis one. And I think that if there was ever a time, if there was ever a place, if anything ends up happening here, I love the idea of looking at Memphis because they have a million different pieces. They could definitely make some of the contracts work. And the idea of Kevin Durant, Ja Morant, and Jaren Jackson Jr., the three of those guys together facing the Warriors and trying to like take their crown away now would be, to me, one of the most compelling things. Having the Western Conference that loaded back up would be one of the most compelling things. Plus, it makes it easier on the Raptors, so I like that too. Stanley Cup Finals, Game 5 tonight. Do we see it wrap up?
I think so. I've been thinking about this for, I guess, one full day since... you know, Tampa just got outworked in overtime, and it just doesn't feel promising. And I've wanted to bet on Tampa. If anyone's going to come back in a series, they had a little bit of pushback. I don't see it. I feel like it's an exhausted Tampa Bay Lightning. You're headed back to one of the most electric arenas, which was surprising. We never got to see much Colorado Avalanche games this year. That arena, Ball Arena, maybe top that we've seen during the playoffs. You got the altitude issue, whether that's big or not. It's definitely something that people have mentioned. And you have a bunch of star players that are questionable to play. I see that as stacking up the odds against Tampa Bay. And the way that Colorado has played over the last few games, it really does feel like it's out of reach.
To me, same thing. Think it's over. But I'm always a hopeful person where I always hope that we get more.
And we've bet against the Lightning before and learned our lesson. So
yeah, I think this is a little different now, having to need them to rip off three straight against Colorado, two on the road. It seems like a pretty daunting task. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how much that would be in the back of their minds as they enter a game like this. Yes, I believe in championship pedigree, and I believe in Steven Stamkos and lesser Kucherov's mentality here, but still. But Hedman and all this different stuff and how they're going to try and how they'll lay it on the line and what they showed in the last game. But I do wonder if that doubt creeps in if you fall down 2-0 in a game like this on the road, and how much you just go, boy, it's just a lot. It's a lot that's in front of you that you need to overcome. So I think it's human nature. I think they'll be battling it. It's just very, very, very uphill for them. So, yes, I think Colorado is a very comfortable favorite tonight. It's very likely that they wrap this thing up. What I'm more curious about is how this impacts the way we perceive Tampa, because they have had this really great run, and they are a really, really good team. But nobody thinks that back-to-back Stanley Cups is a dynasty. Absolutely not. Absolutely not. You got to be nuts to think it's a dynasty. No one's thinking even back to those LA Kings teams. I know that wasn't back-to-back, but like, oh, wow, dynasty. Those Chicago Blackhawks teams were not a dynasty. That doesn't happen. So in order to be one in modern day, you rip off three straight cups and you get to have that discussion. So that's gone. So I think that like the ceiling of the Tampa Bay Lightning discussion changes drastically, like quite a bit. They go from, hey, that's a good team this decade. They were a real, hey, remember that Tampa Bay run? They had a really good team. Back-to-back cups is really impressive, but not as an all-time team. They don't get to be an all-time team by losing, especially in five games to Colorado Avalanche. I don't care about Braden Point. I don't care about what the caveats are. That's not what history remembers. For the Colorado Avalanche, however, it changes a lot.
I wonder if history also starts to remember for the Tampa Bay Lightning that these were both pandemic seasons. They played Montreal in the Stanley Cup Finals. Mm-hmm. And I think that you can start to poke holes at, were they really good or were they fortunate? And I don't believe that as much as it sounds like a valid argument. I still think that they deserve some of the flowers. But
yeah, but you brought it up.
But I brought it up, and it's something I've seen, and it's something that has kind of stuck with me when we look at the legacy of Tampa. And it's easy to make excuses now, because if they do lose this, you're looking for reasons why we might have overestimated them. But just something that I think is a conversation piece that we might have moving forward.
Here's the thing. It absolutely is, because I already went over that in the Stanley Cup final, you don't usually get the two best teams, right? You mm-hmm. had to go
and
back.
This is the first time that they had to play the best team remaining.
But it's not that Tampa didn't play the best team. It's that they played the worst teams. It's that they played the Dallas Stars, who the next year didn't mm-hmm. make the playoffs, and the Montreal Canadiens, who the next year got the first overall pick in the NHL draft in the finals. And yes, the road to the cup matters, but ultimately, what do people remember most is the Stanley Cup finals, unless you're in the market that lost to the Lightning. So, yeah, I don't think that history is going to remember that Tampa beat the Florida Panthers, or that Tampa overcame demons and it's just that's not going to be the part of this that gets remembered from their run. It's going to be the cup finals. And yeah, when people look at that, they are going to say bubble cup. Mm-hmm. They are going to say beat Dallas Stars, beat Montreal Canadiens, both draft lottery teams the following year, and Montreal number one. And that they made it to a Stanley Cup final, but then they got completely outclassed. This is not going to go down as a memorable one if it gets wrapped up in five. Like, it's going to be memorable for how unmemorable it was, especially if Colorado skates them off the ice tonight. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot of potential for the Colorado Avalanche moving forward. I think that it absolutely should shape the way that this team approaches free agency with a lot of different guys. You're not going to fault dudes who leave, but knowing that they have Cale Makar, and that they have him for the rest of his career, essentially, that they're going to be able to re-sign Nathan MacKinnon, that he wants to be there, that he's already publicly talking about taking less money, that they have Gabe Landeskog under contract, that they have Mikko Rantanen under contract, that they have this blue line, that they have these players, that they've won, that they have this coach, that they have... This is my other interesting thing I really want to kind of spin later with Kipper, but what I really love, too, is their front office of having Joe Sakic and Steve Yzerman and a new rivalry of, like, Sakic is beating a team that Yzerman helped build. And now if we're talking about, like, best front office guys in the game, Yzerman was always the dude. Yzerman. Oh, Detroit's getting Yzerman. And they've got a couple of guys that are really good rookies. They got the Calder winner this year, so maybe they're going to be back on the come up in Detroit. But Joe Sakic, like, sneaky extending the rivalry into a post-career position. I'm a big fan of it. I'm a big fan of this. I got to tell you, I love this narrative, love this discussion. So, yeah, I do think that Tampa is losing a little bit more than just one Stanley Cup. No one's saying they're bums. No one's saying that they're not great champions. You saw that in the way that they even lost that game against Colorado. But, yeah, I do think that there is... It's more of a lost legacy than it is the potential of what could have been gained is what's lost. Not that they get disrespected, but yeah, they go from being one of the all-time NHL teams to a good and solid Stanley Cup winner, a deserving back-to-back champion.
And on the other side, I mean, I think it just validates how good Colorado was and is. You know, Cale Makar is about to win the Conn Smythe, the Norris, and the Stanley Cup in the same week. Like, that's legendary. You have that guy moving forward. MacKinnon basically validated that he is better than McDavid and Matthews in terms of winning his first cup over those three. And that's those three are always often compared with each other. So MacKinnon gets that first cup. I think there's a lot to gain for the Colorado Avalanche in this run. We're going to see that maybe tonight. I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves. But we're going to get into the A-list next. And this is the first time in history that you can actually cry over spilled milk. That's next. Fan Morning Show with JD and Ailish.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Good morning show, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Happy Friday. That's some good stuff on the A-list. You know when you just you log on and there's just a pile of good stuff on the internet? That was me yesterday. Had to narrow it down to three. I think you're going to like all three of them, JD. So we'll start today's A-list.
Now it's time for the A-list.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
Bing bong.
What's up, baby?
We know that Dan Snyder, Washington Commanders owner's in a lot of heat right now. He's in a workplace misconduct investigation. He might have to sell the team. It's not great. Well, here's something else that came out during all the testimonies. A former employee testifying in one of the many investigations. He exposed that Snyder wanted to purchase land from Nationals owner Mark Lerner near FedEx Field. He was pissed because the asking price was really high, in his opinion, but buys it anyway. In order to get back at him for the extravagant prices, he orders this employee to pour milk in Lerner's suite. Here's the transcript. This was on a non-game day. Dan asked me to pour milk on the carpet under the seating in Mark Lerner's suite so that the suite would smell like sour milk when the Lerner family came in on game day. I owe Mr. Lerner an apology, but I did it because Dan told me to. So you're going to go into your suite and it's going to reek. Like, you know, the smell of sour milk is like, ugh. Like, I just got the chills reading this story. But what a little petty move by this guy who's just like the ultimate villain. Disgusting.
It's funny though, because if he's not the ultimate villain, this is like, if this is an owner we like, right? If this is Mark Cuban, and we find out Mark Cuban did that, we'd be like, oh, haha, Mark
Good
Cuban.
One.
Like, yeah.
you got
so,
him.
Yeah, exactly. So I actually think that that's kind of like a pretty innocent prank. Like, yes, Dan Snyder is the worst. Who likes Dan Snyder? I'm not trying to back him. My only point here is that, to me, this was actually something where I go, that's about as innocent of a prank and kind of a good collegiate prank that I would want to hear. And I, like, if anything, it's kind of lame and uncreative. Like, when we were kids, you would always have stuff like trying to put tuna in someone's locker, right? Like, we would do that.
Or when,
like,
Dwight Schrute put a fish in the Michael Scott Paper Company's roof.
Right. Same thing. Exactly. That's
or when Packer took a large bowel movement on the floor of Michael Scott's office.
That's the point, is that's not the prank. Gist of that episode, Ailish, was that that's not a prank, and they didn't know it was going. The fish thing is like a traditional thing of, it's a way of stinking something up, stink prank. Mm-hmm. Milk is kind of just, meh, it's whatever. It's a different variation of that. What I'd love to know is real stories of billionaires and the things that they've done to other billionaires out of spite,
that'd be a
revenge.
Good show.
And yeah, of course it would be a good show. The only thing is they have no they have nothing to gain.
No.
So they would never do it. But it would be amazing, amazing to know those things. Like, what do they actually do to one another when they do not like one another? It's probably way more nefarious, like, well, we hired an investigative journalist to act there. It's like, oh, okay, never mind.
They're committing tax fraud.
Yeah, but I do think that that would be cool to find out. That's all I thought of with the story. What's
next? Text in your best pranks. I want to read them. Okay, so popular hockey podcast, Bitten Chicklets, had former NHLer who only played, 98 games? Oh, my God, I just lost his name. Who played in a few European cities, et cetera. I sent it to Josh. Anyway, the clip is absolutely hilarious of what happens in one of his KHL teams. If you're an animal lover, you might not like it. Let's play the clip.
Do you have any crazy stories from when you were overseas?
So I was not there for this, but this is what I've been told. There was a 7 or 8 game where they didn't have a lot of puck luck on both nets. So after practice one day, and this story has been vouched for by a lot of imports who I trust, they may or may not have brought out a live animal, taken a sword, and ended the life of that animal, and taken the blood of that animal into both goal creases and spread it over them for good luck. And like I said, one of my good friends who was standing there at the time, I remember them pulling out a sword like straight from Aladdin.
That's what they're going to do to the guys on the Live Tour if they bogey the 18th hole.
Okay, that was Drew Shore. Sorry, I blacked out on that one. But okay, so sacrificing an animal on the ice, spreading the blood in the crease. The normal practice in the KHL, apparently.
I have no comments on this.
It's tough. It's real tough. I have played hockey in Russia, and I would not be surprised for this to be something that has happened quite frequently when I was there. I played in a tournament, and Vladimir Putin was at our game, and I had never been more terrified to play a hockey game. The vibes were eerie. So if that's the practice in the KHL, I'm staying here to play in a beer league.
I just need to find out that that was a rat, okay?
Like, I'll tell you what the animal was after off the air.
Great. Not a rat.
Not a rat. A much larger animal.
That makes me sad.
Yeah.
Great.
It's not a lovable, it's not a dog. It's not like
okay, well, that's
a golden
good.
Retriever.
Well, yeah, I didn't think it was that until you said it. Now it's in everybody's head. No one thought that until you made that happen.
Okay, last one. Cleveland announcer Tom Hamilton did not sugarcoat things when it came to his comments on Miguel Sano during the live broadcast on Wednesday's Twins game between Cleveland and Minnesota. The first baseman is absent from the game and has been because of injury. And this is what he said live on the air.
Miguel Sano, he's not hurt. He's just fat. I mean, that's as brutally honest as we can be. He's down in Fort Myers trying to get in shape.
All right, Sano, sorry. He's 6'4", 272 pounds, but he had meniscus surgery in May. It's June, and he's recovering. And you know, you tear your meniscus, you're not ripping the gym. But the announcer
says
just
who?
Said, "Well, I don't know. Like, I think you have to take some time off."
You don't think about all the athletes, Ailish, that tear their meniscus and don't balloon weight. You still have to be more cognizant of
your diet. I think there's a little bit of a buffer. You don't need to call the guy fat on the radio.
I disagree. Mm-hmm. I think that you're in pro sports. I know a lot of people cry over this, and like, we live in this sensitivity culture where nobody's allowed to say anything or tell the truth anymore about things. Is that you just have to be like, no, it's fine, Miguel. Oh, Miguel Sano, who cares if it's millions of dollars for you? You know, you were recovering and they obviously gave you a diet plan and you didn't follow it, but it's cool, man. No one will say anything. Like, that's not fair. Hey, it's only been a month, buddy. A month. You're telling me that a pro athlete over the course of a month and during the recovery should be that out of shape? Like, that he is? Like, no. So, again, you can cry all you want, all the crybabies that cry about this kind of stuff. I think that this is just like a guy being funny and a guy being honest, and that we have gone way too far when it comes to like the way people react to certain language and to certain words and to what context means. So, yeah, I think that this is totally within the realm of being appropriate or funny or whatever it is. And like, yeah, Miguel Sano, be in better shape.
No, he's going to come back and have something to prove. Miguel Sano, comeback player of the year.
By the way, before we take the break, Bon Saint-Jean to everybody in Quebec, all right? You lucky ducks with your day off today. If Ailish would have stayed in Montreal.
Honestly, I should have stayed for the week and had another day off. One tiny, tiny quick one before we take a break. A text in about pranks. A bunch of years ago, I was in the Dominican with 11 other guys. The last night we were there, my friend Dave was kind of messed up, slow dancing in the disco with a 60-year-old woman of the night. One of us snapped a photo upon returning home and sent the photo to the local paper. Mr. and Mrs. Dave are thrilled to announce the engagement of their son, Dave. Still my favorite prank, Will from
Durham.
That's
pretty good. I like that. That's a good one, Will.
All right. We're going to talk to Ben Annis after the break, who's probably pranked you, hopefully, in your time working together. It's the Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan.